Give it a quick roundup of influential bands. We're having Mike Insing lead the way on this parade.
Okay.
Welcome back to the show.
That reminds me, I was in band in junior high. I played clarinet and I quit because I got on my nerves. So I don't listen to much Benny Goodman these days.
Oh, man.
I'm going way off on a tangent, but I did manage to, when I was in junior high band, we were in a parade for Gerald Ford, who was from Grand Rapids, and it was about a year before he was president. So,
wow.
Yeah, we were in a parade. It's an annual parade they used to do for Ford in East Grand Rapids, where he's from, and wound up hearing him speak in somebody's backyard, like I was 10 feet away. So that was, very, you know, less than a year later, he was president. So anyway, I digress. Let's start off the thing by digressing. I was talking to you. There's a book by Tom Moon called 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. There's a whole series of books, places to visit before you die. And Tom Moon is a really cool critic because he, one thing, his musical choices are very diverse. And the other thing is he picks out records that might not, that were under the radar. And you go, you got to, it's one of these, you got to hear this. You know, he put some obvious choices in the book, but and that's what I'm doing with these 10 artists. I'm picking 4 albums by each artist, and some of them are very well known, and of course this will make a list, but it's not really the top 4. It's a couple of them, or one or two of each is going to be, you got to check this out too, if you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be for the casual fan and for the fan that wants to hear more than they're used to from an artist, or try to understand why this makes the artist so great. I think all these artists are great on my list, consistently great over the years, and heck of a lot more peaks than valleys. But anyway, I just did an alphabetical order, if that's fine.
That's fine. Yeah.
And of course, you got to start with the Beatles. And did you check out Let It Be, by the way, the Let It Be sessions?
That's still trying to get for that, as you know, such a long.
Yeah. And it takes about an hour. You got to not suffer through, but Lennon's pretty stoned in the first hour or so. And, yeah. But he gets a lot more animated as this thing goes on, and he winds up, I don't want to give too much away, but it's worth checking out. So that's a little sidelight, the Let It Be, who directed that? The guy that did King Kong and
Peter Jackson.
Peter Jackson. Yeah, I couldn't remember his name.
And thanks, 3 hours on his parade.
And for dessert, you should track down the Let It Be movie, because there's stuff in the movie that didn't make the cut too. There's a great, I was just talking about that with my wife in the car the other day. There's a great take of I Got a Feeling where halfway through Paul, he realizes they just got the song and he goes, "Good morning." And that's not in the Peter Jackson thing, but stuff like that. And there's different in studio stuff that's not in the movie.
Happens.
Yeah, sorry about that. Anyway, if you're gonna talk about the Beatles, I know several people that have problems with the early Beatles. This stuff sounds dated to them, and myself included. I actually didn't get into the Beatles till I was in my maybe 12, 13 years old, and by that time they'd broken up already. And I remember at the time thinking that early stuff just sounded, even for a 12-year-old, it sounded dated. But then I really started listening to all the albums, the early stuff, and I'm going, yep, there's a lot going on here.
They're actually hinting at stuff. Yeah.
That's what now?
They're actually hinting at stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Observing.
This album that wasn't on my list, but there's even a track on their very first album, which they recorded on, I think, one day, Please Please Me, the British album, that hints at psychedelia to come. It's called There's a Place. It's got weird harmonies, and the place is It's My Mind, which is hinting at psychedelia already. I can go to my mind and imagine things, that type of thing. So,
nice.
So it's fun. It's fun to go back and trace the roots of, you know, the Beatles' roots continuing on. In fact, One After 909 is from those sessions, and it didn't show up until the Let It Be album, their second to last album. But anyway, if you're gonna, a good way to get used to or appreciate the early Beatles is pick up the BBC sessions CDs. There's four CDs worth. There's two CD sets. And they do a lot of covers that they never put on albums on those. And they do a heck of a lot of joking around. And you can see how Monty Python was influenced by them.
Right.
And of course, in the Beatles sense, you know, I think was influenced by the Goons. You probably heard of the Goon Show.
Awesome.
Peter Sellers and a couple other people. I can't remember the other names, but. And the Goons were produced by George Martin prior to the Beatles. And I think I've got a Peter Sellers album that, separate from the Goons, that George Martin produced, where you can hear the orchestral stuff Martin put on there that sound like a Beatle outtake. So, but that sense of humor that they never really got on their records, other than, you know, some lyric, funny lyrics, you know, Yellow Submarine is very humorous, stuff like that. But you hear them really joking around on the BBC sessions. And that's worth picking up if you want to get a great glimpse of the early Beatles, you know, pre-Rubber Soul or even pre-Help. I think it ends around the time of Help, those sessions. And of course, that started a bunch of artists did BBC sessions later. So, but then the next album, you got to talk about Sgt. Pepper. I mean, it's a cliche now, and now it's hip to say it's not their best album. And in some ways it isn't. Song for song, it isn't, but there's, if you go back and listen to it again, and especially the remastered Giles Martin edition that came out a few years back, there's just something about that record that I still can't fathom what it would have been like in 1967 to put that on, and nobody had heard anything like that, you know. It may be dated now, it might be a little flower powery and stuff, and again, the songs aren't that strong, really, except for something like A Day in the Life. I love Good Morning, Good Morning. But there's this magic to that record that they recreated themselves. It does sound like a brand new band. So that's,
they went for stages. So
what's that?
They went for stages.
Yeah. Oh, they went through stages. Probably from their fifth album on, they kept changing all the time. But you know, Pepper has A Day in the Life, which is. I did a Fab Four on the Beatles channel one time, and that was one of my selections. And it's just this huge, dramatic song that it's got the big final chord. It kind of seals the album, kind of seals the late 60s or the psychedelic era of the 60s. It's just one of those big boom moments in music. And of course, it's fun that some vinyl editions has that weird inner groove that. Once A Day in the Life fades out and it goes to the center of the record, there's like sound effects for about a loop that can, if you don't have an automatic return in your turntable, it'll play forever. And it sounds like they're saying, I never do see Connie, but it's just, it's just a bunch of sound bites they got from a party. They threw them all together and mixed the tape up. And it's on the CD copy too. It runs for about 20 seconds, just to give you an idea. Just that's the kind of inventiveness that's on Sgt. Pepper, that they were just trying to do, let's do stuff we've never done before. And they tried purposely to make every song sound different from the one before. And didn't know, you know, they weren't, there's better songs on Revolver and other albums, but the whole spirit of that album, it's one of those records that it'll never age. It ages in some ways, but it's also timeless, if that makes sense. But in the next album they did, a couple albums after Pepper, was the White Album, or what I always indignantly called the Beatles, because that's the actual name. And you got the White Album because of the white cover. That, to me, is my favorite Beatle album, because it's 30 songs. It's more eclectic and diverse than anything they ever did. And it sounds to me like it was recorded 2 weeks ago yet. It's just, all their other albums, they're great, but they always sound like the 60s. The White Album sounds like the 70s and beyond, you know? You hear John Lennon finding his John Lennon voice for his solo stuff. He starts to sound like later Lennon. And you got heavy metal with Helter Skelter. You got Revolution 9, which people hated at the time, but now everyone's saying how great it was and inventive. Ringo does his first song, which is a country rock type song, Don't Pass Me By. Harrison does four songs, more than he'd ever done before. That's just, to me, the best album they ever did. I never get tired of it, and I always listen to it end to end. People say it made a better single album. I don't agree with that. You need the whole record, because it ebbs and flows just so beautifully. So, anyway, I don't know how much of a Beatle fan you are, but I'm sure you're familiar with these records. So,
yeah, I'm never been great at naming albums for the most part, but I'm solid at just at least remembering the beats and tempos of certain songs. And to me, it's just like, you know, they were just summing up again, what many music journalists will tell you is how, you know, they were, again, the British music revolution, and hence, you know, new revolution, you know.
Yeah.
And it is kind of wild how America still tries to censor a few things from overseas now and again. But, you know, at that point, you know, they were kind of breaking that whole taboo. And
yeah, there's stuff on the White Album that is really provocative. Why don't we do it in the road? I mean, I'm surprised I got away with that in 68, you know, but it was the Beatles. Okay, we'll put it out, you know. There wasn't a warning sticker on it or anything, you know.
You're right.
It was way before Tipper Gore, I guess. But yeah, that's, and then I love the last song Ringo sings, Good Night. It's just, you get this nightmarish 8.5 minute Revolution 9. It's like the apocalypse. And then this soothing music, this going back to classical music, the strings, and then Ringo sings Good Night. Now it's time to say good. Just, and it sounded like there, you know, almost, some people said it sounded like it would be their last record because it's the finality of that last track. But, and there's so much more on that record too. I love, there's certain sections of the songs that I can't wait to get to. Like Mother Nature's Son has this beautiful passage. I'm not quite sure where it is, but it's just the blend of the notes. And it's just amazing. It's just an amazing record. That's not only my favorite Beatles album, it's probably my favorite album of all time. So anyway, then you got to go to Abbey Road.
Right.
Where they did what has been called the greatest greatest joining together scrap heaps of they took a bunch of parts of songs that they were working on and just made that medley on side two medleys actually. That it's a work of genius. I mean, it's an overrated term, but overused term, I mean, but and it's fun. When you watch a lot of B documentary, they're working on some of those songs back then already, the year before, or that summer, or the couple months before Abbey Road. So it's fun, you know, they do Bathroom Window on there, and I think Something Pops Up, which isn't the medley, but and then that final three songs where it ends with the guitar duo with John, Paul, and George. That just signposted the 70s guitar bands more than anything, I think. And it's just, and then Paul had to get the last word. They put a little scrap of Her Majesty, you know. And oh, that's one thing about Abbey Road that ticks me off. In the 90s, remember there was always hidden tracks on CDs? You'd be like,
always the fun Easter egg that.
Yeah, 8 minutes would go by and then all of a sudden a song would pop up. I think Her Majesty started that because it was an accident. They had the tape. I think they recorded over another tape or whatever.
And I'm sure every other rock artist in the 80s and 90s was doing it, much like how 90s rap artists were sampling Motown from the 60s and 70s.
Yep, like, sampling as well. Yep.
And it's like the same thing with even just movies that were cheap to find. It's just like they would just find the most bizarre cult movies that would play on antenna channels and just scoop it up.
Yep. Well, even more clever is the way side one of Abbey Road ends, where it's an 8-minute song, very repetitious, but very great. I Want You, She's So Heavy, and all of a sudden it just stops dead cold. Like somebody mm-hmm. pulled the plug on your stereo. Kind of yep. like the end of this, kind of like the end of the, I don't know if that was influenced that, but it just, you know, and it was always fun. You can never, I can never quite remember when it happens. I know it happens shortly after the sound starts coming in, but I can never get the exact moment. All of a sudden, it's done, you know? So, yeah. Abbey Road's one, it's a great finale. And there's the endless argument, is Let It Be their last album or Abbey Road? Let It Be was released last, but the sessions for Let It Be were recorded before Abbey Road, except for one song, I think, and that was just a remix thing. So I would argue Abbey Road's their last album, but that's an endless argument. And it's really pointless because, okay, how about the Let It Be remaster? That's their last album, you know, the one that just came out, you know. You could go on and on with it. The Red and Blue albums were their last albums, you know.
Trivial details. So let's move on to your next few picks. You got Bob okay. Dylan.
Yep. Dylan, I went with two of them very obvious, or three of them are very obvious choices. Blonde on Blonde, Blood on the Tracks, and a Highway 61 Revisited is considered prime Dylan. And I threw in the Basement Tapes, which is Dylan and the band. That's got a kind of a White Album feel too. It's very varied and maybe not as varied as the White Album, but just the band sings some songs, and it's just one of those, okay, you're a fly on the wall. It's got a almost a rehearsal feel to it. But there's some awesome songs in there, like This Wheel's on Fire, I think is the last track on the original release. And it was recorded in the late 60s, wasn't released till 75. But that's worth picking up. But yeah, Blonde on Blonde. I don't know if you ever see the movie with John Cusack, High Fidelity?
Yep.
And that great scene with Jack Black when, you don't have Blonde on Blonde? And he hands the guy, comes, I think he actually gives him the album. It's going to be okay, you know. And that, I have vivid memory of that record. I remember hearing about it. And finally buying it one day, and I played it once, or, you know, I started playing it. I don't quite get it. And the next time I went to play it, the second the needle hit the groove, I got it. It was like a almost like a drug high or something. I instantly got it, the sound of it and everything. So
damn.
Well, that's because it does start off with a stoner song. But, but no, I don't do drugs, but music has been a drug for me many times. So, and there was another, I remember thinking when I used to drink beer that Dylan sounded better when you had a few beers. Well, I quit drinking beer years ago, and Dylan still sounds, I can still love Dylan records. So I got over that after a while. Mm.
Perfect.
But then you got Blood on the Tracks, which is his most emotional record. I think it's about the breakup of him and his wife has overshadows it. And, of course, Tangled Up in Blue is a classic song. The last track, Buckets of Rain, is there's a Van Morrison song I'll talk about later. Reminds me of that song. It's just sheer emotion. And Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts is an epic song. That kind of jumps it kind of out of context with the rest of the album, but it works anyway. And
it's okay to have the bastard child that steals the show.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some provocative lyrics in there. Was he really singing about that? You know, did he really say that? You know, maybe. Not bad language, but just what he's singing about. I don't know if I want to cite the lyric here, but, I've been shooting in the dark too long. He's talking about masturbation, you know. He's talking about a woman he hasn't seen anymore. And that I've been shooting in the dark too long. When something isn't right, it's wrong. It's like only Dylan could get away with something like that, you know.
Right.
So
you can say it on the radio just because no one knows what it means.
Yeah. Oh, like Lou Reed had that line in Walk on the Wild Side that got slipped under the radar and got on AM radio, you know. Even when she was giving head, you know, so
yeah,
that's in there. Then Highway 61 Revisited is astounding. It kicks off with Like a Rolling Stone, But the second track, Tombstone Blues, I've described that album as defying time and space. It's like the drum work and the guitar work. I'm going, this thing that was recorded in 1965, it sounds space age. You know, it's just amazing song. And then he's got a great melody run on the next song, and then Desolation Row. I was lucky enough, the last time I saw Dylan in Grand Rapids, he pulled out Desolation Row, which is an epic, like it's like an Old Testament fable for 14 minutes or whatever it is. Queen Jane Approximate. There's no bad tracks on that record. Most of these records, that is the case. But
good.
Yeah, that is definitely Dylan's rock album, Highway 61 Revisited.
Alrighty, so let's move on to Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, first album, Are You Experienced, is essential for any music library, even if you don't like Hendrix. It's watching you, man,
from that watchtower.
Yeah, that comes a little later. Purple Haze is on there. Half the album is just stuff signature songs for any artist. Then I threw in Electric Ladyland, which is my favorite Hendrix album. It's a two record set. And I think he out Beatles the Beatles for psychedelia on that. It's even, their psychedelic songs are good and even great, but they sound dated. The Electric Ladyland doesn't sound dated, especially side three. Don't play that when you're driving. It may hypnotize you.
Oh dear.
Yeah, especially at night, and yeah, you might drift off the road. But that's, and then you know, all along the Watchtower, that's on that record. And he's got two versions of Voodoo Child. He's got a long bluesy version on side one, and side four has the more popular version. I like both. It depends on what mood you're in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a track on there, kicks off side two, that one of the other members of the Experience sings. That's kind of a weak point, but for the most part, that's one to have. You got to have Electric Ladyland. Now, the other two, he only did three albums, studio albums, in his lifetime. Access Boldest Love is the one in the middle, which is, it's a transitional record. It has its flaws, but the first and the third are the great ones. And then, but I'd also recommend a box set, if you can find it, called Stages, which is four CDs, a concert from 67, 68, 69, and 70 with Hendrix and the whatever band he was with. That's worth finding. And I mean, there's been a lot of Hendrix anthologies and live concerts and stuff, but that's one worth picking up. In fact, I had it years ago, and like an idiot, I sold it, and I recently rebought it. So if you're going to get a Hendrix live album, that's the one to get. And then there's also one called Blues, Hendrix Blues, which I thought was just going to be an anthology of his bluesy song, but it kind of works as an album all its own. It's some studio outtakes, and that's... It's whoever conceived it, they did a great job. It just, and there's been other like Crash Landing, Midnight Lightning, posthumous Hendrix albums, but that's the one to get for studio. So I'd recommend Stages for live Hendrix and Blues for studio, because it works like an album out all on its own. It's really conceived very well. Anyway, Van Morrison?
Totally. Let's do him, and we can do probably some of the other stuff for another day.
Okay, maybe do 5 and 5?
Sure.
Yep. Okay, Beatles, Stone, Hendrix, Van Morrison. Yeah, Van Morrison, it's controversial late, but let's not even go there.
It's interesting how he just kind of comes in. I don't know how I would kind of describe him, but he's definitely kind of in the background and very influential to other artists, where it's kind of like how Leonard Skinner throws out a reference to just so blatantly to Neil Young, you know, in one of their hit songs. Yeah. And it's just like,
he's an artist in some ways. Yeah. He's influenced Bruce Springsteen, I would say.
Oh, definitely. Much like Leonard Cohen and Tom Waits kind of go hand in hand together with the talking while we're actually got music playing in the background, you know? not I wasn't really singing, but I'm talking.
I wasn't going to buy his latest album because of his anti-mask statements, but I bought it anyway, and there's really not much on there that I didn't. You can listen to stuff that you don't like the lyrics and still like the music, so I picked it up anyway. It's a good album, his latest. But anyway, yeah. the four I came up with for the list here were Astral Weeks, which was very early, been very one of the most transcendent albums you're ever going to hear. The title track kicks it off, Astral Weeks, and it's got, I think, three layers of strings on it, and it just builds and builds. It's one of the most spiritual songs you're ever going to hear. Way up in heaven, you know, just it's phenomenal. I hate to use the word phenomenal again, but it's a transcendent record.
Do you think he really evolves over time, or does he kind of just do a lot of the same, but it's
well, good? Yeah, in a way, he does a lot of mystical type records, but I know I got a book on him, but I can't remember the author, but I think he listed like 15 of his albums in a row that he said, okay, this is not a good period for him, and I like all those albums, so they're in my top 10 for a reason. I just like almost everything they've ever done, you know, with a few exceptions. So
nice.
But Astral Weeks, yeah, the only issue, his voice is still young and it's a little harsh, but the music that backs it up is it makes up for it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a track, side two kicks off with what's it called? Can't remember now. Sitting right over here. The Way the Young Lovers Do, and it's one of these songs that it's got horns and bass and drums, and it always sounds like it's gonna come crashing down, and they just keep, they never lose the tempo, but it's
right.
The whole song is the music's kind of fighting against itself, and it just keeps going and it stays together. It's really, and I like stuff like that, you know. It works in spite of itself, that kind of
thing. When they try to do it nowadays, it's always just so digitized because everything is digital now. But
yeah,
you got to give all this kudos.
Manipulate the tapes and yeah.
Yeah, they had to stitch the tracks that way.
Yeah. And then Slim Slow Slider, which has one of the worst titles of a song, but it's just a heartbreaking song, though. It's a great way to end a record.
Mm-hmm.
That's that. And then as far as his live albums, It's Too Late to Stop Now is probably the definitive live from Van Morrison. It gets its title from what he yells at the end of the concert. It's too late to stop now, you know. And in fact, it's a song from Astral Weeks when he does it. But I also love A Night in San Francisco. It's just one of these albums, live albums, where you can just hear everybody on stage is just playing off each other, and it's got a big, you know, big band and everything. He does some classic Van Morrison and some great covers. That's one to pick up. Then Hymns to the Silence. That's probably, a lot of people aren't that crazy about that one, but it's got a spoken word track I really like, called on Hindford Street.
Mm-hmm.
That's it's got like a spooky organ and he just recites something, but it's very cinematic. And it's got a lot of, you know, he actually covers Just a Closer Walk with the End there. He does some spiritual songs, and I really like it. It's a double CD album. And then Too Long in Exile is another album around that time that's really, really, really good. And a lot of the stuff from that wound up on Night in San Francisco. And he loves to end records with these epic, drawn-out, long songs that kind of build and build. And Exile's got maybe three or four of those. Or Too Long in Exile. Not Exile on Main Street. That's another band. So nice. Then we got Graham Parker, who's probably the least well-known artist on this list. Graham Parker and The Rumor. If you've ever seen the movie This Is 40, he shows up in that as Graham Parker. He's just playing himself. I was lucky enough to meet him when he played in Grand Rapids at a small club, and we had, like, my friend and I had front row seats, and got to talk to him a little bit afterwards. He made some joke about, so do you people all sit around and light candles and play grand polka music, you know? So I had that British sense of humor. His first two albums, or first couple of, first four albums are probably his best in the 70s. But I stayed with him, and I still like anything new that he puts out. He's often confused. I've played him in the car with people, and they think it's Elvis Costello, who I like a lot too.
But totally different, yeah.
And I think there's an image thing there, problem with him, because he does sound like him, but he also does his own thing. And their musical styles are similar too, but I can play both of them. And Grant Parker is just the one I really get into just a little bit more. But I recommend Howlin' Wind, his first album. It's got a really nice ballad called Between You and Me, which I think they just used the demo for on the album instead of the band version.
Probably did.
Yeah, and it's a really nice haunting song. How was the title?
Perfect. There's no point in re-performing it.
Yeah, his early 70 or his late 70s stuff has a Dylan and the Band Basement Tapes feel somewhat to it, but then it's with some more R&B thrown in. It's a nice mix of music. You can see the influences, but he's also kind of pointing forward to the 80s, you know, or moving music forward from that. The next album would be Heat Treatment, which is a little sparser, but just, you know, it's a great record too. And then his masterpiece is Squeezing Out Sparks, which at the time people were saying, oh, it's new wave, but it's the new wave had come and gone, but that record holds up. It's just, it's an amazing record. It's got
these
one great
five that you summed up, who would you say evolved the most or even stands out the most if you can't choose?
Oh, the Beatles, definitely. From start to finish, it's staggering what they did in those 6-7 years. You know, from 63 to 70, it's just, yeah, God, they almost evolved track by track, you know. Mm-hmm. So I've definitely said the Beatles evolved the most. And it's like, I think they were so big they couldn't stay together. The big band, or the big bang, you know, in one for music from the 50s to the 70s. Of course, they go back that far too. Their early recordings go in the 50s. But
mm-hmm.
There's one more Vic Grant Parker I want you to mention called Stick to Me, which is uneven, but it's got some really great stuff on it. The Heat in Harlem, the title track. I pretty much talk about his first four albums here. But then he kind of went off more Elvis Costello sounding, but still good enough for me to throw in anytime I feel like it, you know.
So. Perfect.
We'll return after these messages.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsy, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR, we add them to our queues, we wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide all across the globe. We are in the US. We are in the UK. We are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan. We're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
We're on all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening.
It's a jacked up.
Jack Doe!